And today we want to tell you about a new reality show that debuts this Sunday that aims to shed light on a faith community that often feels itself misunderstood, especially in the wake of 9/11. TLC's All American Muslim series focuses on one of the largest and most established communities of American Muslims in the U.S. That's in Dearborn, Michigan. All the characters in the series may be Muslim American, but it soon becomes clear that even within the same family, they each lead distinct lives and have different opinions. One of the families featured is the Amans, a well-established local couple with four adult children who observe their faith in different ways. Suhaila Amon is the eldest daughter, and she's with us now to tell us a little bit more about All American Muslim. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me with you.
So why did you all decide to take part in this series? And I really want to know if there were what those behind-the-scenes conversations were before you all decided to agree. Or maybe you all, maybe there wasn't.
You know, for the most part, there was a consensus that this was something that we would, you know, be interested in doing, knowing that we were going to be able to work with a network like TLC that has very strong reputation in the world of media. And it was important for us to be able to tell our story in our own voice, as opposed to having somebody else try to tell it for us.
Were you worried at all that it might be Jersey Shore, you know, trying to, well, not Jersey Shore, because you're obviously, you're very modest, very lovely, by the way, beautiful.
Thank you.
For those who, obviously nobody can see you but me, but you have a very beautiful outfit and a lovely hijab, which is kind of sparkly. But we would all worry that it would turn into Jersey Shore, that there would be like craziness happening that
no,
would not reflect well.
It never gets to the point where it's raunchy in
well,
any way.
Not raunchy, but definitely interesting. And there's definitely some tensions there. Tensions, and I don't mean that in a trivial way, but there's some real discussions about real things. One of those real things is the whole question of people marrying outside the faith or people converting to the faith. The first episode focuses on your sister Shadia, who met Jeff, who was an Irish Catholic who converted to Islam to marry her while she was working in a bar. And you have a very different kind of view of it. You don't drink alcohol, right? Oh. You wear hijab. Your sister Shadia, who has dyed red hair and tattoos, let's just play a short clip of her talking to somebody she meets while tailgating, and she asks if her family came with her.
My family doesn't like country music. We're slowly recruiting them, but...
But is it like a cultural thing,
no,
or is it just because they don't
no,
like it?
No, you know what? My brother's gone to concerts before. He actually got me into country music, and he's really, really religious.
Sometimes people stereotype,
yeah,
and as soon as somebody walks in the neighborhood and is a different color than what your skin is, all of a sudden, oh my God, they're going to bomb my house. No,
always.
They're not.
And that's why I love looking the way that I do, because people meet me, they get to know me, they, oh, you're cool, where are you from?
What's your family think about that?
Nothing. They call me redneck.
Okay, well, okay. I didn't hear that, they're calling you her redneck. But there is a real moment here where, because Jeff is converting. And one of the things that was interesting was the conversation within the family where one of the sisters, was it you, who asks, well, how would you feel if one of your kids came home and said, oh, by the way, I'm becoming a nun?
Yeah, I think that was me that said that. You know, I think it's important that people realize that these are questions that come up in every faith and every culture and every community. And the beautiful thing about our family is that they embraced Jeff wholeheartedly when Shadia first brought him to the family and introduced him to us. It was never an issue of, is he going to convert? It was something that gradually came about. And Jeff is a wonderful young man. And I think what mattered most to the family was that he was treating Shadia right and he respected the family and our culture, and he was so interested in learning more about it.
Well, wait, I'm sorry, I have to stop you there, because I actually did watch the episode. Your father does not exactly take that point of view, that he only cared that she treated her right. He did care very deeply that...
When they were dating, no, he did. His first concern was, are you going to be good to my daughter? Yes, you know, I think in every faith, a person would have that issue, just as, you know, you'll see Jeff's mom has that issue with dealing with your child converting to another faith. For my father, though Shadia may not be as conservative as he may wish her to be or embrace the faith as strongly, to him it is important that the people are married and have the same faith so that when you have children, you're not fighting those battles that really do come up. And I think a lot of people who get into those interreligious marriages without thinking about the future and how they're going to raise their kids, those are issues you definitely will face.
Now, I have to say that there are there was one tidbit that I picked up, which I thought was interesting. As they're preparing for the wedding, some of the women who don't wear hijab are at the beauty salon getting their hair done, getting all duded up. You are getting your hijab, like, specially wrapped. That was a beauty tip that I was not aware of. I didn't realize that. That's like a thing. Like, you can, it's, what do you call that? A wrapper?
They have hijab salons that style your hijab that actually will create these beautiful designs. Mine was actually very simply done compared to other scarf designs that you'll see. And it's something that, you know, people came up to be able to have that and take that enjoyment and, you know, getting all dolled up for something special.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're talking about All American Muslim. It's a new reality series on TLC that follows the lives of five Muslim American families in Dearborn, Michigan. I'm joined by one of the family members featured, Suhaila Amin. The program is premiering on Sunday, so I don't know how many people have seen it online, but already there have been some critical comments in the blogosphere from people who say that this is politically correct, that it's, I don't know if I can use this term, a whitewash, that in essence it doesn't address the things about Islam that people really are troubled by, like plural marriage, like the role of women in the faith, or even as it's practiced, not so much in the religion, but in the culture, particularly the worldwide culture. How would respond to that?
Unfortunately, I think people tend to look at only what the media is giving you. And when you're looking at remote rural areas in the Middle East, you're not really getting what Islam is all about. Because at the end of the day, Islam is something that many embrace of every color, culture, race.
I have to just push you on this point, and I don't mean to be obnoxious about it, but this piece is in part a reaction to 9/11 in the sense of feeling that your faith community has been cast in a negative light. That's not the media. That's behavior. That is the actions of individuals who claim that their behavior was in the name of Islam. And the criticism of those who admittedly haven't seen it, have not seen the series yet, but their argument is, why isn't that a discussion? Why isn't this behavior by a minority of people part of the conversation?
This isn't a show about politics. This is a show about reality. This is a show about people living their lives, American citizens who live in this country, have grown in this country, been born and raised here for the most part, and are flourishing and developing in this nation, embracing the values that this great nation was founded upon.
Was it fun?
It was. It was a good time. It was interesting because a lot of us are connected, whether professionally or personally. The families all are familiar with one another. So it was nice to see this coming together in a sense where it brought everybody even closer.
Were you all scared at all that maybe letting the cameras in would open up some can of worms that you weren't prepared for?
You know, I have to honestly say that was something that we have no qualms about at all. We have a very strong family bond. I think I can say that for the rest of the families as well. We all have a very strong connection with our families, and that's something that cannot be severed.
Suhaila Amin is one of the family members featured in All American Muslim, an 8-episode series which premieres on TLC this Sunday. She was kind enough to join us in our studios here in Washington, D.C. Suhaila, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me with you.
And that is the Kiki music. Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Today on the show, it's getting to be winter at the end of the year. It's going to be Hollywood awards season very, very soon. So we're going to look at some of the movies that are coming out between now and the end of the year, perhaps into the cold of winter. And we'll talk a little bit about the little movies, the big movies, and the ones for which we have high hopes, middling hopes, and perhaps no hope at all. We're also going to talk about one of our favorite topics, which is music on television, be it a theme song, a score, or perhaps the appropriate use of montage, even, shows that we think make excellent use of music. And then, as always, we will talk to you about what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's meet everybody. I'm going to start today with Glenn Weldon. Glenn, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the movies editor at NPR.org.
As you may remember, if you listened to the show last week, Stephen Thompson this week is staycationing at home, and he is not with us this week. We are fortunate to have with us our esteemed producer, Mike Katzeff, who is on the mic, as we say once again. Mike Katzeff, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So the people know, what do you do when you're not doing this?
Oh my God. I produce and film and edit a lot of the Tiny Desk concerts. I produce Alt Latino. I produce this show. I do so much. I'm a doer of things.
You're Mike of all trades.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, we are very glad to have you back. And I should say before we go on, you will also remember if you heard last week's show that I was on vacation in the mountains.
How was Rancho Relaxo?
Rancho Relaxo was everything that I possibly could have hoped for.
Is that really what it was called?
No.
Oh, damn.
No. It's called, I will say what it's called. It's called Lakeview at Fontana, and it's a little spa. They call it a rustic chic spa resort in the Smoky Mountains. It is everything that they advertise it to be. And I want to thank the delightful, delicious Barry Hardiman for her wonderful contributions last week.
Yep.
She, as always, made me feel not missed at all, but nevertheless, I have taken my chair back. So, winter movies, awards season. Glenn Weldon, how is the awards season shaping up for you movie-wise?
Well, the two big movies that are probably going to throw down against each other are The Iron Lady and mm-hmm. Albert Nobbs.
Stole mine!
I'm not stealing them because I'm not going to talk too much about them because I, frankly, don't want to see these movies. I just want to see Meryl Streep and Glenn Close get into an octagon together and just sit down and settle it once and for all.
That's on the red carpet.
So these two movies are... Meryl Streep is in The Iron Lady playing
Margaret Thatcher. Right. And Albert Nobbs is playing a woman who dresses as a man to get ahead in the 18th century, 17th century, 15th century.
It's 19th century or early 20th century Dublin. This is a passion project for Glenn Close. She's been working on the script for 15 or 20 years and wrote a big piece of the script herself and bought the rights and produced it.
She's an interesting lady. She's had an interesting career resurgence. I think she's one of those actresses who, for a while, it seemed kind of unclear what was going to happen to her. And then, of course, she got Damages and began to be really recognized for her dramatic work in that. So it's good to see her in a big project that she's extremely excited about.
Absolutely. And it looks like a handsome movie, high production values and all that sort of thing.
Right,
so it's absolutely going to be an awards contender.
Right. And both these movies are going to soak up Oscars like so much bread with gravy. I mean, the biggest acting either of these ladies are going to do is in the 15 seconds it takes them to get from the seat up to the podium and they say, I'm just such a shock.
I had no idea. So when you're not looking at ladies in helmet-like wigs, what else will you be paying attention to?
There's a huge animated film coming out on December 23rd called The Adventures of Tintin, based on the French comic. It's directed by Steven Spielberg.
Peter Jackson's also involved.
Yeah. From the clips, from the trailers, it seems like this is one film which, even though it's animated, computer animated, it seems to have set up base camp squarely in the uncanny valley because it is just creepy looking. These characters are weird.
This is sort of the style, right, where they film the actors and then animate over it.
Yeah,
it's sort of in that style that
the Polar Express
did.
Polar Express is especially one where when you look at it, I just think they didn't have it yet. Whatever they were doing, they didn't have it yet.
Well, here's the thing with those movies. When it tries to be so specific, it's not cartoony enough, and so it weirds us out because it's so close to humans, but it's not there.
It's not. And it's not trying to be. It's trying to imitate at least somewhat the look of the comics. But
why didn't they just do regular computer animation? Why didn't they do just regular animation?
It's a very good question.
Or live action.
Right. And Marty Scorsese, I call him Marty, coming out with Hugo, which is another 3D kids movie. I have no interest, but it's based on a book, Cabinet of Hugo Cabret.
Hugo Cabret, which I don't know, but I have to say, Linda and I think, saw this trailer, and I kind of looked at her at the time and went, but there is terrific buzz around this movie. People are talking about it making a real serious arty case for 3D, and so I'm kind of curious about it.
I'm curious because it's Scorsese trying to do a kids movie, too.
Yeah.
It could be awesome.
Am I a clown? The film I'm really not looking forward to, except in the sense I really am, is called I Melt With You. Have you seen anything about this film?
I have seen some things about it. I have heard that it is extremely terrible.
It is Thomas Jane, Rob Lowe, other dude, and wait for it, Jeremy Piven.
Okay.
Otherwise called Four Douchebags in a Funeral. The trailer is truly repellent. It's about these four brohams who get together every year for a bacchanal with the hookers and the drugs and they share, wait for it, a dark secret that gets exposed.
Well, me and my bros do that too, though.
Of course you do. Of course
with
you do.
With the dark secret.
But yeah, are you smug in a self-consciously arty way?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You've heard the band's music, right?
Oh, that's mean.
That was mean.
It's self-consciously smug, and it really bugs
me. I recommend, if you're at all curious about this movie, and I'm not sure that you should be, but if you are, there are some truly wonderfully funny reviews of it kicking around on the internet from people who have seen it at festivals and who speak about it in the hushed tones of the truly humbled by the badness. Yeah, of
the hushed tones of the true train wreck aficionado.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's spoken about not as an ordinary bad film, but as an extraordinary bad film.
Excellent. See?
So I kind of want to see it.
Awesome. Yeah. And Nancy, I went the completely non-ironic route, and I chose films that I'm actually looking forward to.
I cannot wait to hear.
As mentioned, Glenn stole my Albert Nobbs and my Iron Lady.
Stole your Nobbs.
I know.
My goodness. Didn't that go to an interesting place?
Because, you know.
To be fair, I just tweaked your Nobbs.
It's true. Oh, God. But, you know, given how I am about all the things that, you know, get me going in a movie, you know, the repression and the tight mannerisms and all of that. How exactly am I going to pass up a story about a cross-dressing Irish butler and a severe British prime minister? That you should also know about a film called A Separation, which is a Persian drama, an Iranian drama that we talked about a little bit on Monkey See when it was at the Toronto Film Festival. But if we're going the small film route, I am probably most looking forward to a movie called Tyrannosaur, which is the directorial debut of the actor Paddy Considine. And it is actually due out here in the U.S. on, I think, the 18th of November, so possibly not strictly a winter film, but it certainly has some awards buzz behind it, not least for the performance of an actress named Olivia Colman. She plays a battered woman whose husband is such a psychopath and whose options are so circumscribed that she falls into friendship with a violent, angry drunk who lives near where she lives in the sort of council estates of somewhere in middle Great Britain. It sounds dreadful, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds like the sort of thing that would just be emotionally battering, but I am so looking forward to it because I'm hearing such good things about it and what a great ensemble drama it is.
All right. Well, Mike Katz, if you always bring a slightly younger point of view to the table, we're all basically the same old fogey. So speak to me about how the award season is shaping up for you.
I'm going
to
get all youthful on you and talk about a movie based on a 1974 British spy novel by John McCarran. Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. It is a Cold War spy thriller, kind of a paranoid espionage tale. It is the next film from Tomas Alfredson, who did Let the Right One In, which was sleek, stark vampire movie from Sweden.
They did this story for the BBC,
I think. Yeah, it was a miniseries a while back.
And they sent me the... I actually have it. I have the BBC version if you would like to see it.
So. I would watch it.
Yeah.
I totally love these sorts of, you know, low-tech espionage thrillers. I like that bleak, washed-out look.
You were the one who liked
Rubicon.
Rubicon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's in that same vein, like Parallax View, mm-hmm. Conversations.
Yeah.
The Congo.
Yeah, I love those movies. Yeah.
This story isn't just a Cold War espionage thriller. It's one of the quintessential Cold War espionage thrillers.
Yeah.
It's right up there.
I mean, I'll admit I haven't read the book, but I've read a couple other things by John Le Carré.
That's Gary Oldman, right?
Gary Oldman.
Tom Hardy is in it.
Colin Firth,
yeah.
Mark Strong, who you'll remember from Green Lantern, and your friend Benedict Cumberbatch.
Benedict Cumberbatch!
So this looks just super cool. I don't know if it'll be Oscar contender or not, but it just looks like a really cool political thriller.
Mm-hmm. So espionage thriller.
It's like so right up my alley.
Anything else up your alley?
A couple other things. I mean, I always kind of look for directors that I've seen in the past that are putting out new things. I mean, some of the bigger names of movies that don't totally appeal to me. Cameron Crowe has a new movie. Spielberg has a new movie. David Gordon Green has a new movie, but it looks like sort of closer to the dopier side.
Now, The Sitter with Jonah Hill.
Yeah. How can you resist the trailer for We Bought a Zoo or whatever that is?
Oh, yeah.
The Cameron Crowe movie.
I love Cameron Crowe movies, well, except for Elizabethtown, but man, that trailer looked bad. But a couple things from directors that I do like. The Descendants is coming out soon.
Yeah.
Which is Alexander Payne, right, who did one of my favorite movies of all time, Election.
Yes, mine too. Mm-hmm.
And also did Sideways, and has George Clooney, so it looks like he's kind of doing his up-in-the-air thing, but darker. And
yeah.
Right. I like the George Clooney in self-parody mode, and that's what he's doing with the mm-hmm. darting eyes. And
yeah.
He can be pretty broad when he does that, but it's a lot better for me than the cool, suave
and that's
guy.
That's also the burn-after-reading Clooney.
Exactly.
And,
sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it's like that guy that weathered and whatever that veneer of his confidence is sort of worn off, and now he's like reconnecting with his fans.
There's meant to be a little haplessness in that character.
Yeah. And it's funny because I wrote on the blog one time about how I like weird Brad Pitt better than regular Brad Pitt, and I'm kind of the same way about Clooney. I enjoy a good straight-up Clooney movie. I think he can be really charming in that regular mode. But in those movies like Burn After Reading and like, to some degree, Ocean's 11, where he has a little bit of that kind of goofy, somewhat off
he can be kooky.
Personality.
I mean, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, he played like kind of a small role in that. I mean, he directed that, but he was very offbeat on that
He's
movie
nutsy
too.
In that movie, in this great, in this kind of great way. I agree with you completely, and it's funny because I never really made that connection between him and Brad Pitt, who have done you know, various things together, and but they're kind of the same way in that way, that they both can be very effective at putting a little spin on that kind of dreamboaty quality that they have.
Yeah. The last one that I'll sort of mention that I'm sort of interested in is Young Adult, which is the new Jason Reitman movie, actually co-written with Diablo Cody, which could be good, could be bad. She sort of tempered her Diablo Cody-ness doing that TV show United States of Terra. So I'm hoping that maybe a few years on she's sort of normal-ish. I actually didn't mind the dialogue as much in Juno as a lot of people did. But it has Charlize Theron and Patton Oswalt, so I'm totally sold on seeing that.
Yeah, and then the premise is an arrogant fiction writer. It's the second warning sign, by the way. Your main character is a fiction writer. Returns to her high school to score with her old boyfriend. And what I like about this premise is that the selfishness that is inherent in a lot of main characters in romantic comedies is not downplayed. It's not. We're not trying to pretend it's not there. It is... she is an awful person and is played up.
I agree with you. And the funny thing about Juno is it's gotten very easy, and it's not inaccurate to say that some of the dialogue in Juno was sort of insufferable, particularly in the first, chunk of that movie. But it's also true that there were some extraordinarily affecting things in that movie. And you know, you can chalk a lot of that up to some very, very good performances that they got from some of those actors. I think every performance in that film was substantially better than it could have been if not thought out carefully enough. But there's also some very good storytelling in that movie about, you know, characters in a legitimately difficult situation, complex characters. And so despite my frustration with some of her persona and some of her overwriting, I certainly remain hopeful that she can still turn out a movie that I would really, really like.
I didn't feel her dialogue for Juno was that much more overwritten than, say, something that a Sorkin does. It's just maybe because it was a female character and it was a younger teenager character that it came off as more insufferable crowd going, oh, it's so annoying.
I would still argue like that. The first 15, 20 minutes were more insufferable than most. The Rainn Wilson exchange and all that stuff. But I agree with you that there are other people who write affected dialogue as well.
I also feel like a lot of teenagers do kind of talk like that, though, in a lot of those ways. And sometimes I think the backlash for that came across as like just parents just don't understand.
I get that.
We should listen
to
it.
I don't know. I mean,
like Katziff.
Cody did a lot of decent stuff on United States of Terra, and that was another show that kind of started as kind of crazy and a little too much Diablo Cody, but it evened itself out. Mm-hmm. It came out nicely.
And the other thing is that after she did Juno and had kind of this enormous, enormous success, and in addition to the fact that she had certainly a critical success with United States of Terra, she also had Jennifer's Body, which essentially flopped spectacularly.
I
didn't see it, but I often think that that's actually a very good experience to have, is that you have a huge success, which gives you confidence, but then you have a huge failure, which gives you perspective.
Yeah.
And so I'm very eager to see what she does next, and I'm absolutely, absolutely on board for seeing what her next thing is.
Yeah.
So I agree with you.
And Jason Reitman, I mean, he's done 3 or 4 good movies already at this point. So
I'm with you.
And the last one, which seems like a very odd pick for me, is the new Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. For one reason, and one reason only, Brad Bird is directing. This will be his live-action debut, and he's obviously done the Pixar movies, like Ratatouille.
Well, live-action, with quotes around it.
but still. I actually might go see that just to see what he does in that
I would realm. Love that to be good. I like a good fun Tom Cruise action
movie. I kind of liked the J.J. Abrams one.
Rumor is that this is where Tom Cruise sort of hands off the franchise to Jeremy Renner.
That would be okay with me, too. All right.
That's all I got.
I will say a word for the Cameron Crowe movie. I will say a word for We Bought a Zoo. That's a Matt Damon, and as much as
Scarlett Johansson.
That's
it.
Yeah, those are all people: Matt Damon, Scarlett Johansson, Cameron Crowe. They're all people who I have liked in some things and not in other things. But they're all people who, when properly deployed, I really, really like.
Sure.
And I think, judging from the trailer, specifically with a Cameron Crowe movie, I'm hesitant to go from the trailer because so much of what he does that is really nice is in really small moments.
Right.
And when I was on vacation, I watched Say Anything. You know, when you watch that movie, there are so many really lovely, small things. People remember John Cusack in that movie, but the relationship between the father and the daughter in that movie is full of these really lovely, subtle pieces of writing and acting. And so, you know, he's one where I tend to look out for, you know, it can really go either way.
Is this Cameron Crowe's first movie since Elizabethtown, besides that Pearl Jam documentary?
He made the Pearl Jam documentary. He also made a documentary called The Union, which is about the Elton John and Leon Russell collaboration. So it is his first scripted film that he's that he's directed since Elizabethtown.
So that in and of itself, I'm sort of waiting for him to kind of redeem himself from Elizabethtown, which was very mediocre and milquetoast.
Well, and he's a guy who is pretty well known as a director despite not having made a lot of movies.
Yes.
He is a guy who works and then doesn't make anything that you see for a while, or works for years on things like this Pearl Jam documentary. He's a guy I will always see what he does and give it a shot, and either it'll work or it won't.
Yep.
I would also say a word, surprisingly enough, for Melancholia, which I saw recently at a screening. And this is Lars von Trier. It's Kirsten Dunst and Charlotte Gainsbourg. Charlotte Gainsbourg. In this story of these sisters who have an odd, somewhat estranged relationship, who are, I guess the best way to describe it in a kind of non-spoilery but moderately appropriate way is that their relationship is being challenged by the appearance of a sort of threat, to that a sort of apocalyptic threat to the planet. And it's a very weird movie. I mean, people have told me, you know, this is the Lars von Trier mainstream movie.
Right, yeah. This is him not working under some of the restraints of
Dogma. I mean, I saw
Dogma.
Antichrist.
People who've watched more of his stuff than I have made that point. But to me, it's a very odd movie. It's a very arty movie. And I don't think all of it works, but there is an opening 8-minute segment that is all set to Wagner. It is very much an overture of imagery. And it's not technically part of the narrative, but it works very much like the overture in a musical.
Sets the tone.
Where it sets the tone and you get pieces of themes that you'll see later. It's not scenes from the movie, but it's really, really interesting to see. And it's the kind of movie where if you like movies and you like knowing about movies, it's something that you ought to take yourself to go see. Because even if it doesn't work for you, it really will get you thinking about what do you like about film and what do you find interesting and moving about film. And you might like parts of it and not like other parts of it, but there's some really, really nice work in it.
Plus, you know, angst among the upper class.
There's a lot to recommend it. So I also, in terms of smaller movies, that happens to be one that I've seen that I would definitely recommend people try. The other one I would mention real quickly, I'm going to see The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo for sure.
Yeah. That's going to be huge.
Yeah.
I mean, it's David Fincher.
Right.
I really think that the stuff I've seen from that movie so far, now granted, a lot of that's very stylized trailers and bits like that, but I love the way she looks in this movie. And I think the fear was always, you know, if there's an American version, she's going to be kind of prettied up and she's going to look like a magazine model. She looks, if anything, more like I envisioned her from the book than Noomi Rapace, who is in the Swedish version.
Yep.
I think Daniel Craig is an excellent piece of casting. I think everything about this, I'm very optimistic about. I think Fincher's the perfect director.
Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross doing the score again.
It looks great to me. The tone looks absolutely right. You can't know, but I'm super excited. Yeah. I really think, to tell you the truth, as much as I think the Swedish version is a good movie, I don't think it's a great movie. I don't think it's the best movie that could be made of this.
The first movie was really solid.
But it's not one of those where I think, why would you ever make another movie? You could not possibly top that. When I have seen her, Rooney Mara, in the trailers for this, I think, that's even more what I envision. Uh-huh. She looks even more sort of otherworldly and alien in a way that I'm really kind of excited about. So,
can I say a word for two films very quickly that are coming at the very end of the winter? We're going to get through the next few months, the very serious Oscar-baity rape and repression movies.
Yes.
Then at the end, in February, we're going to get two featherlight things, which I think look to be a lot of fun. The first one is This Means War, about two CIA operatives fighting over the same girl, the girl in this case being Reese Witherspoon. If it moves quickly, and it includes a scene where Tom Hardy and Chris Pine wrestle each other shirtless.
Which it almost certainly will.
Yeah. I think it could really work. The movie, of all these movies that I'm looking forward to most, doesn't come out until February 24th. It's called Wanderlust. It's directed by and written by David Wayne of The State, Stella, and Wet Hot American Summer. Yep. It stars Paul Rudd and Jennifer Aniston. Huh. And it's
Have made a movie together in the past.
That's true. It's filled with actors and comedians I love. A guy loses his job, and as a couple, they set off across America, which makes it seem like a real homage to Lost in America and Albert Brooks films I love. That would be a great way to end a very bleak winter.
Yeah. Very good.
And I'm sorry, I was hoping somebody else would mention, but of course it's going to come back to me.
Sure.
My Week with Marilyn, which is sort of based on an incident where Marilyn Monroe and Laurence Olivier are in a film together. There's a guy on set who works for Olivier who is sort of taking notes and helping out with the production. Another sort of really super glamorous cast. Good word coming out of the festival circuit about...
It's Michelle Williams.
It is Michelle Williams as Marilyn Monroe.
I love and to watch
very,
Michelle Williams.
Very, very fine buzz about how that's shaping up and her performance in particular.
I love to watch her. I think she's just so interesting and so cool. I'm excited to see that as well. Winter movies. Well, thanks, everybody. I think we have inventoried our selections. We will, I'm sure, return to much of this awards bait closer to the end of the year. The other thing we were going to talk about today... You know, we were originally going to talk a little bit about TV theme songs, and then, as it happened, the AV Club had a feature this week on their favorite TV theme songs. So we thought we would go a little bit outside of straight-up theme songs, although certainly that might be part of the discussion, and talk a little bit about how shows that we like use music that we like. Glenn Weldon, what are your thoughts?
Okay. Mike.
Pro.
I am for it. Mike, can you hit me one time? That is what played over the introduction to every episode of the new Battlestar Galactica. They did a very ingenious thing because there is so much to set up about the show every week. You have to kind of buy into the basic premise. So instead of having a theme song where people sing, Cylons are coming, anything like that.
Cylons.
Cyl off. They just have a series of images and a series of words which basically set it up. And while it plays, you hear that nine-note musical phrase, which is actually played on a gamelan, a Balinese... collection of instruments. Yeah,
this is NPR. We know what a gamelan is.
Of course it is. And that phrase...
We invented the gamelan.
You invented the gamelan. The phrase is heard whenever the character played by Tricia Helfer, who may or may not be a figure of another character's imagination, appears on screen. On the surface, it's a very horror movie theme. There's a bit of Exorcist in it. There's a bit of Halloween, a bit of The Thing. But what it serves to do very effectively in those scenes where Tricia Helfer appears as the character named Six is it shears off those scenes from the rest of the run, the rest of the reality of what goes on around it. You know that something is off, something may or may not be happening, it's unsettling, it's insistent, and it's really just perfect. So that's the work of the composer Bear McCreary, who had a very difficult job toward the end of that series run. He had to reveal that the universe, spoiler, that the universe in which this space opera is taking place is actually our universe as well. And the way he chose to do that, the way the producers chose to do that, is by using a Bob Dylan song. There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is. It could have come off really terrible, and I don't think it's as effective as it could be, but just the arrangement of that really made for a really nice sort of slow build. And once you realized what song you were hearing, and then they cut back to a shot of the Earth.
If I remember in that scene, like, for a couple episodes, like, these characters were kind of humming fragments of this melody, and they're kind of frantically trying to write it down, and it eventually all coalesces, and it's sort of all tinged in, like, this kind of, like, New Agey Indian slash Middle Eastern
exactly right,
style
yeah.
thing, and so it's not the Dylan version. Mm-hmm. You know, right. there's kind of parsing out these words mm-hmm. that are the lyrics of the song mm-hmm. in like these very poetic
exactly.
ways.
So it was a really good slow build, and when you realize what it was, it kind of hit home and did exactly what the producers wanted to do.
Yeah.
So it's
cool.
a really consistently a really good use of music.
He's a great composer, actually. Yeah. He's one of those great TV composers. I think he does The Walking Dead.
He's working on The Walking Dead now.
Yeah.
A similar little musical theme that I would point out is also being very, very effective and used in a very similar way is that violin theme from Dexter. So composed by Daniel Licht and is sort of, I guess, the work product also of a guy named Gary Calamar, who is whose name always makes me think of Admiral Akbar, but it's just because I'm 12.
Right.
He's a DJ on one of the bigger stations in the public radio music ecosystem. He has a show on KCRW that's all about digging stuff out of the record store back catalogs. It's about eccentric music and exciting music. This guy has worked on shows like Dexter and 6 Feet Under, which is one that I would point to as a show that uses music well, not just in terms of sort of bumping a scene, but sort of developing characters and story arcs over time, right? They sort of use music to shape your impression of a character over the long term, not just scene to scene.
6 Feet Under was sort of one of those shows that reintroduced the idea that you could make or break a band based on playing them in a TV show. I mean, other shows had done it for years and years and years, but introduced the indie-ness of music. Instead of signing and paying a bunch of money for rights to popular songs, they would go after bands like Arcade Fire when nobody knew who Arcade Fire was, or Death Cab before anyone knew who Death Cab for Cutie was.
Gary Calamar is a guy who works on House, and he's the one who put that Arcade Fire song in that sort of famous episode.
My body is a cage that keeps me from dancing with the one I love, but my mind holds the key. I'm standing on a stage of fear and self-doubt. It's a hollow plane, but they'll clap anyway. My body is a cage that keeps me from dancing with the one I love. My mind holds the key. My mind holds the key.
That song was a Peter Gabriel cover of My Body is a Cage. The scene is about how House is feeling restricted by his injury and by his lameness. Oh, well, he was on a show that lasted about half a season on CBS called Swingtown. That was one of the shows that I first noticed. At the end of the show, they would actually post a playlist of the songs that were in the episode.
Yeah, I mean, that's like a thing music for so many shows now because of that.
And music was really important to that show because it was set in the 70s
it was all about tone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mike Katzeff.
A couple shows that I always think of that use really great music, obviously The Wonder Years, which now that it's on Netflix, I'm noticing that all the music is different. And actually, one of the reasons why it was never digitized or put on DVD for so long was because they couldn't get the rights. If you listen to the theme song, it's not even the...
the Joe Cocker.
Joe Cocker version.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a bummer.
What would you do if I sang out a tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing your song. I will try not to sing out of key.
But I think of Freaks and Geeks also as being a really good example of getting the right music and hitting it the right place. And one of my favorite scenes in all of TV is the scene with Bill, who's played by Martin Starr, who comes home. He's sort of a latchkey kid. He's lonely. And he makes himself a snack and sits in front of the TV and watches Gary Shandling doing some stand-up and just cracks up and cracks up and cracks up, and he's sort of having like his own little moment. It's this beautiful, beautiful scene.
That is a beautiful scene.
And it's set to The Who's I'm One.
Every year is the same and I feel it again. I'm a loser, no chance to win. Leaves start falling, come down is calling. Loneliness starts sinking in, but I'm one. I'm one. And I can see that this is me, and I will be. You'll all see I'm the one.
And you know, I'm not a crier, but I considered crying at that moment. It's a really beautiful moment, and it's funny, but very, very sweet. And that show always kind of pulled out those perfect little moments. And the other one I was going to say, I mean, we've talked about Friday Night Lights a million times.
That's on my list, too.
Two parts that always strike a bell with me with that show is actually in the very first season, the use of the song Deviltown,
yep.
Which is like the montage
exactly
at the end of the first one,
say.
Which is... The Tony Luca version of a Daniel Johnson song, which is a really great song.
I was living in a devil town. I didn't know it was a devil town. Oh Lord, it really brings me down about the devil town. All my friends were vampires. Didn't know they were vampires. Turns out I was a vampire myself in Devil Town.
It's like the theme song for that show.
It really is.
Once you've seen that scene, it is impossible to imagine that scene with any other music. That song is so important to the fact that that moment near the end of that season, as the season is ending, and the both for the show and for the team, it's a happy song, it's a catchy song, but on the other hand, there is kind of this underlying, like, you know, slight melancholy to it.
I mean, it's
not
one of those super sad
forever.
Songs in a major key, so it sounds right. Sing-along, but it's so about being suffocated by where you are, and that show was so much about embracing and feeling suffocated where, you know,
exactly.
In that small town situation.
And if I remember, isn't the parade taking place in slow motion? Aren't you
at
a remove
mm-hmm.
from
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Yeah. You are
watching this from the outside.
Yeah, so it feels very nostalgic.
It feels nostalgic, but it also feels distancing, intentionally mm-hmm. distancing, so you see that these people are very happy, but you're not sharing that emotion because you are at a remove.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. You get the impression after, especially that very first long, long arc of that first season, see how far they've come since that pilot and all these things, and this may or may not be the best thing that ever happened to some
right.
of these kids. The very last episode, I don't want to give too much away, but after all these seasons, five seasons, we've seen a million games narrated or announced by you know, this faceless announcer that we always hear. You hear the coaches talking and pepping up the team and like all the sounds of the game. The very last game, it mostly goes completely to silence. You don't really hear any soundtrack of the game itself. And you hear kind of like, it's just mostly just little, very stark little pieces of music coming in. It uses silence in a very interesting way because there is music, but it doesn't feel like it. It feels very, like you say, pulled back from this moment. It's very, very cinematic. And I actually had to look it up. It's this song called If These Trees Could Talk by a band called Deus Ex Machina. And it eventually segues into a song by Yonzi, who is from Sigur Rós. Mm. But there's a moment near the end where the music finally kind of swells up. You know, it passes in the air, and you feel like you've seen that movie a million times where you know what's going to happen, but it actually, like, fades into, you know, 6 months ahead of time. You actually initially don't see mm-hmm. the outcome, but the music played such an important part in that scene that
yeah.
it was... really amazing.
Yep.
The other one that I would mention on Friday Night Lights is a scene that takes place when they sort of change the cast over, mm-hmm. and he's with kind of the new kids. There's a scene in the locker room at halftime. They have just been mercilessly beaten, and they're bleeding and swollen and broken. And they used a Sufjan Stevens recording of Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, which is technically a sort of a Christmas song. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's on his Christmas record.
Sure.
Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace. Streams of mercy never ceasing, call for songs of loudest praise. Teach me some melodious sonnet, sung by flame.
Sacred song.
Yeah.
They don't play it for the lyrics. They don't really play it for that. And yet it has the same heft, and it is absolutely gorgeous. And I will say, unfortunately, Stephen is not here. He would tell you this is an absolutely, absolutely treasured recording in his life. And I was shocked to see it in that, because it's such a piece of outside-the-box thinking that takes a little bit of imagination. So that's the other one that I would mention. So definitely Friday Night Lights was on my list. I was also, surprisingly enough, going to mention Chuck, which is a much-loved and little-watched NBC show, which has managed to creak out 5 seasons. It's currently in its final run. They're another one, like Friday Night Lights, that has made some really nice use of popular current indie music. They've used some Bon Iver, they've used some thermals, they've used some really cool stuff where you just, you know, you hear a good song and it helps keep a good scene going. So that's one. But the other show I wanted to mention, and this again is sort of me returning to something I've said a million times, when I think about a TV show that makes really excellent use of music, I think about Jimmy Fallon's show, because it's such a template for late night shows to have very much like you have a guest, you have a band, and then everybody goes home. And when you have musicians, maybe you have the musician come and talk on the couch in addition to performing over on the stage, and then you're done. Because he chose from the beginning to work with the Roots, mm-hmm. who are way too good a band to just be your house band who you never really see or interact with, he chose to share that show, essentially, with a massively great band, which he somehow mm-hmm. got to be his house band. And they have been smart enough on that show from the absolute beginning to realize you don't get that band and then have music be an afterthought on your show. So they have had everything from, you know, obviously everybody knows about the Justin Timberlake stuff that they've done with the Roots.
I said a hip-hop, a hippie to the hippie to the hip-hop, you don't stop.
Rock it to the bang-bang, boogie, sit up, jump, the boogie, rock the rhythm of the boogie beat.
Now what you hear is not a test, I'm rapping to the beat.
And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet.
Now Peter Piper picked breakfast,
over rock rhyme,
Humpty Dumpty fell down,
that's his dog time,
a Jackie Nibble,
what Nibble,
and he was quick,
was that a master cut, that's his ass, so did.
Now here's a little story I got to tell
about three bad brothers you know so well.
I started way back in history with that.
They had an absolutely wonderful Springsteen show where he performed with the Roots. They had they've had these kind of salute weeks to the Rolling Stones. You know, they do these comedy bits that incorporate music, some of which include outside musicians and some of which don't. Really, really inventive, interesting, and a shift on the template that greatly increases the reliance on music in a pretty well-established format.
The thing I like about that is that, you know, they do the joke bits, but Jimmy Fallon's not a bad musician. He's a pretty good singer.
He can participate credibly at the very least.
And there's such an obvious affection for music, a serious passion for music that sort of underlies all of that. You know, I think that's key to it. its success.
My whole thing about that show that I say all the time is that the show is so much about happiness. It's so much about a really upbeat, happy, energetic, inclusive feeling, and it's so right to include a band like The Roots. It was such a smart thing to do.
It's really cool to see other musicians come in and want to play with them as their house band. So you'll see Paul Simon, who has one of the best backing bands himself, but he wanted to play a special version that it gives like these guest spots with these big figures and indie bands. They have a tendency to feel more special because there's Questlove playing drums instead of someone else.
And that brings us to our final piece of the show. What is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Surprisingly enough, going to see contemporary fiction Red.
You're kidding.
Yeah. It's something I deliberately distanced myself from after grad school because I had seen way too many readings, and they were starting to sour me on a book and sometimes even an author. Because there's only so many times you can hear the question, so where do you get your ideas? Before you tire of it. There's a complicated algorithm in my head. I'm curious if anybody else feels this, but when I go to a reading, I want it to be a reading and not a performance.
Define the difference, actually.
Okay. If the author is too performative, too slick, too practiced, I will turn against that author. Now, something like Selected Shorts, where it's an actor reading a story, I am all over. That's great. But there's something about an author enjoying him or herself too much while they read me their work, which kind of bugs me. So DC is not, for better or for worse, one of those cities that a lot of like mid-list fiction writers come to. God knows if there's a political book or a history book or a biography, we're gonna see those people. But precious few, I will say, fiction writers, or at least contemporary, especially debut fiction writers, come through the city. But we went to see my pal Chris Adrian, author of the magnificent The Great Night, which
so good,
which I have pimped on this podcast.
I am partway through that book right now, and I will say I concur.
And he read alongside Emma Donahue, who wrote the book Room, as part of the Penn Faulkner reading series at the Folger Shakespeare Library, which is, of course, a beautiful space. Emma Donahue skirted the line for me in the very beginning because the book Room is told from a five-year-old point of view. And when you read the book, there's a starkness to it, a blankness of affect that when you hear her reading it is not there because she's doing kind of Shirley Temple voice. She's kind of pitching it to, it's like, oh, don't hurt me, daddy, like that kind of like stuff, which is just...
She's trying to do too much five-year-old sound, I think.
That softened very quick. But what didn't fade away is her practice. Like, she's answered these questions before. However, it is great to be in a room with people who care about fiction enough to ask questions that are hopelessly nerdy, and also to hear it discussed in a way, in an open and honest and committed way. So I'm going to be doing more of it from now on.
Yeah, and the Folger has a great series.
Yeah.
I think my favorite evening there involved a handful of writers, including Michael Cunningham and Christopher Buckley, who are both sensational in two very, very different ways, and were just tremendous fun.
And what is making you happy this week, Trey Graham?
Well, for reasons that are better left unspecified, but which may have involved karaoke, I have the song "The Party's Over" on an endless loop in my head today. It is a sad downer of a song.
It is.
So it is, of course, making me feel fantastic.
Right.
But what is actually making me happy is thinking in a slightly larger way about Judy Holliday, who is the lady who made it famous in the musical Bells Are Ringing. If you haven't seen it, oh listener to this podcast, it is a thing you must see. Judy Holliday is also known for playing the dingbat in Born Yesterday, which I believe is what she won her Oscar for. And she did it with... And deservedly so. She beat out Gloria Swanson that year for the Oscar, if I remember correctly, for Sunset Boulevard. Because she played this character with a kind of comic precision that was most likely only possible because she was, in fact, not stupid, not a dingbat, but brilliant. She had an IQ of around 170, 175. If you are one of the whippersnappers who listen to this podcast and you have not yet discovered Judy Holliday, I urge you to make this the next thing you do because she is emphatically of the awesome.
Absolutely. Excellent choice. Mike Katzeff, what is making you happy this
this weekend I watched the movie Paul, which came out, I think, this spring. It left probably the week after it came out literally nobody watched it. I don't think it even got very good critical reviews.
I liked it.
And I really dug it. It's sort of a sci-fi buddy road comedy. It's with people you know like Simon Pegg and Nick Frost of Spaced and Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz. It was supposed to be directed by Edgar Wright, who did all of those movies, but he was busy doing Scott Pilgrim. So instead, it's directed by Greg Mottola, who did Superbad and more recently Adventureland.
The awesome Adventureland, mm-hmm. which I also
really
love and nobody appreciated.
No, it's great.
Both really good comedies, but also a lot of heart to them. And I think by him directing sort of what normally would be kind of a ramshackle, you know, buddy comedy, actually made it have a lot of heart, and it has like this indie feel. It's shot really beautifully. It also has a really great cast of really funny people, like Kristen Wiig, Jason Bateman, Jane Lynch, Bill Hader, Joe Latruglia. And I'm not really sure why it bombed. It had a lot of those elements that I really liked in the movie. It was very funny and smart about how it approached aliens and sci-fi culture and nerd culture when it comes
really
to aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And it depicted nerds in a way that they should be depicted. Like, they weren't geeky, socially inept creatures. They weren't super geeky. They were just into, really into the things that they were into. They opened the movie with them at Comic-Con in San Diego. It's a really funny montage, but at the heart of it, they're just so glad to be there, mm-hmm. and seeing like all these things that they love, and they're super psyched, you know, as friends, as buddies, to go do this together.
Funny movie, and you haven't mentioned the voice of Paul.
Oh yeah, that's right, Seth Rogen, who does actually a really decent job as this sort of
exasperated
alien who's been there since 1947 and is just anxious to get away,
just looking for a way out.
Right. Yeah, and it's got some nice twists and turns
yeah.
in there.
Yeah, so. I think my favorite clip from that is one of the ones they were handing out as teaser clips, where he brings the bird back to life and then does something unexpected to it.
So I would say totally rent this movie.
I agree.
It's really fun.
Its lack of success also kind of mystified me, and I was trying to figure out, was it Seth Rogen fatigue? Was it from the elevator pitch? You think this is going to be making fun of geeks, and I think some of the people who might have gone to see it might have been expecting a more overt satire. There's also a very persistent element of atheist theme, or at least
a
counter-religious theme,
yeah.
which is a very English thing, but it is not an American thing.
Yeah, not calculated to appeal to the broad movie-going public.
That's
absolutely
true.
Not.
But I don't know if they would have even necessarily have seen that in the first place anyway. I feel like it was aimed towards...
Yeah, I don't know if that had enough effect on the word of mouth for that to be...
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, I feel like it's aimed towards people who love space and Shaun of the Dead. It's aimed towards people who love Superbad and the Apatow movies.
Yeah, we shouldn't make it sound like high art or anything, but it is a fun buddy road.
It's
alien
really funny.
Comedy.
I think that's a good one, and one I was bummed out didn't do better too.
Yeah,
so
rent it. It's good.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, outstanding choice. There is nobody who has seen me in the last 48 hours or spoken to me who does not know that what is making me happy in reality is having been on vacation for a week. But according to the Zaxxon machine rule, I will not make that the actual thing making me happy.
Can we really institute a Zaxxon?
Yeah, that would be awesome.
I will say that while I was on vacation, I did read a lot. I did not have a TV. I did not miss it for a second. I did not regret being unplugged at all. And I spent much of my drive back from North Carolina listening to The Art of Fielding, which is a current sort of contemporary fiction, which is about guys who play baseball at a Midwestern college. And as much as I had enjoyed devouring many, many cheap novels while I was on vacation, this was kind of getting back into sort of actual literary fiction. And so I'm going to say that getting back into my audiobook habit, driving through the mountains of North Carolina, listening to The Art of Fielding, which is a fine, fine book so far, again, was definitely made me happy, as did all the paperback novels, as did reading the MTV oral history, and as did getting about half of the way through The Great Night, which Glenn mentioned earlier. So
I just want to read that MTV book, too.
Yeah. Oh, the MTV book is great. I'll loan it to you.
Yeah.
I have that one. Cool. So that's what's making me happy this week, gorging on culture and then coming back to my lovely job and all my friends. Speaking of which, that is the end of our show for this week. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, Weldon. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. That's Trey with an E and Graham like the cracker. You can follow our esteemed producer and panelist, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike, in addition to being a producer and a panelist, is involved in the band Hello Come In, which provides our in-and-out music that you're dancing to right now. You can also follow our dearly missing pal, Stephen Thompson, at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. So thanks, everybody, for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. It seems like hardly a month goes by without seeing celebrity lawyer Gloria Allred on television. Allred's unshy use of the media to call attention to her clients' causes earns the respect of some, the irritation of others. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates spoke with Allred recently about her current work. She's representing the woman who is accusing Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain of sexual assault.
Herman Cain stood tall, hands clasped before his double-breasted suit jacket, and listened quietly while Lynn Wood, the powerful anti-defamation lawyer he'd hired, explained that he's represented both people accused of crimes and people who were the victims of them.
I've also had the opportunity in my law practice to represent victims of sexual assault. When they have come to my law office, I did not take them out and parade them in front of the cameras in a national press conference and then arrange for them to go on a campaign with the media to give one interview after another after another.
That was a direct slap at Gloria Allred, who had indeed held a press conference the day before introducing Sharon Bialik to the nation. She was one of the women who came forward to say Cain had pressed unwanted sexual attention on her years ago when she was seeking a job.
I said, "What are you doing? You know I have a boyfriend. This isn't what I came here for." Mr. Cain said, "You want a job, right?"
Allred frequently goes before the media with clients, often women, who feel they've been unjustly treated, and she doesn't apologize for wielding the media like a cudgel as she seeks justice for her people.
We are fighting a David and Goliath battle, or a Davida and Goliath battle. And we are up against, you know, very powerful, very well-funded sources. So the court of public opinion does matter.
So, dressed in her trademark St. John knits, impeccably made up and coiffed, Allred makes clients such as Sharon Bialik visible. Sometimes.
If it accomplishes our clients' goals, first and foremost, to speak out about it publicly, then we'll do it. But both the client and myself have to be convinced that this is best for the client.
A longtime feminist, Allred graduated from Loyola Law School in 1974. She was one of a tiny handful of female law students. And while she has clients who have briefly become household names, she says she has scores more who will remain confidential because of settlements her firm has won on their behalf.
You know, we've taken on the rich, the powerful, the famous. Government, large corporations, small businesses, batterers, murderers, wrongdoers of many types.
Those wrongdoers include an Atlantic City casino that has fired several middle-aged cocktail waitresses, ostensibly because they don't flatter the skimpy new uniforms the casino has ordered them to wear. An actress who says director Roman Polanski forced sex on her when she was working for him as a teenager. The family of Nicole Brown Simpson. Allred is aware that some people consider her the celebrity equivalent of an ambulance chaser, but says all her clients seek her out.
We can only take a small fraction of all of the individuals who contact us. And if we can't help people, we will try to refer them.
In the 35 years or so she's practiced, Allred estimates her firm has earned about $250 million in settlements for her clients. She racks up hours because she is a self-professed workaholic.
I love what I do, and people's problems are not 9 to 5, so my work is not 9 to 5.
It's more like 24/7, and don't even talk to her about stopping.
I never see myself retiring. Everybody can make a difference in their own way, but we can make a very big difference, and we want to continue to do that for as long as we can.
So chances are you'll be seeing Gloria Allred on TV again in the near future. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.